hour, I want to talk to you about method and definitions of economics. And if you have a syllabus, again, I hope you've picked up a copy of it in the back there, you can see some of the topics that I intend to talk about in this first hour. But before we get into it, since everybody has some interest in economics here, what happened to the stock market yesterday? Anybody? You're there.
Went down
200. Yeah, it was the Dow Jones Index. Dow plunges 207 points. Fifth largest drop in recent history. And not on a percentage basis, but on an absolute point basis. The more interesting story, though, about the stock market, this is USA Today, is a story called The Quiet Correction. And it's this story. I'll just read a couple of excerpts from it. On the New York Stock Exchange, 80% of stocks are down 10% or more from their 52-week highs. 56% are down 15% or more. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is a very narrow selection of stocks, about 30 stocks, and there are thousands of stocks traded on the stock markets. Thousands of companies have issued stock, and their stocks are traded not only on the New York Stock Exchange, but the American Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and other stock exchanges. And these indicators are much more sobering than even a 200-point drop in the New York, in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Those broad indicators that the writer covers in that article. Economists are always giving predictions, and I don't intend to give any prediction. But it is this sort of what the author calls a stealth correction, a quiet correction, he calls it, that precedes or has preceded in the past very dramatic drops in the stock market. Now, if you look at what happened in 1987, for example, the last time there was a major movement in the market, sometimes called a crash, you find prior to a one-day drop of 500 points for several months, or for about 2 months preceding it, a quiet drop in the value of stocks. And then all of a sudden, in one day, they just dropped 500 points. Same thing happened in 1929. I'm not going to say the same thing is going to happen this week or this month, but that's been the pattern in the past, and you may want to keep an eye on it, just to watch it. These stock market crashes, so-called, just don't happen without warning. In 1929 and again in 1987, there was plenty of warning for what was going to happen if people kept an eye on the broad movement of stocks. Well, in any case, let's get back to the subject of economic theory. And today I want to talk about some more about secular economics. Our beginning topics are empiricism and rationalism. And I need to explain to you in some greater detail why secular economics, which we've mentioned in the first 3 hours, has failed. Secular economics is a failure. And I will quote those words from the secular economists themselves. Early in the history of the discipline, even before Adam Smith, now keep in mind Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, the question of the proper method, how do you do economics, what's the proper method, arose. And one of the early answers was the empirical and mathematical method. You combine observation and the use of mathematics in doing economics. And this came to be known in this century as positivism. Positivism. It's part of a general movement of positivism. But in the 17th century, you see William Petty. You might want to make a note of his name. William Petty, P-E-T-T-Y. He's an early proponent of this method. He says, The method I take in doing economics or whatever I'm doing, instead of using only comparative and superlative words, he's not going to use just English prose, he says, and intellectual arguments, I have taken the course as a specimen of the political arithmetic. That's what he called it, political arithmetic. To express myself in terms of number, weight, or measure, to use only arguments of sense. See the empiricism here? He's going to express himself in number, weight, and measure. He's not going to use prose or just what he calls intellectual arguments, logical arguments. He's using only arguments of sense, and to consider only such causes as have visible foundations in nature. He's going to restrict himself to empiricism. Empiricism in philosophy generally is the notion that what we learn comes through the senses. Everything we know comes through our senses. That's the only route to truth. That's the only way of attaining truth or obtaining truth is through the senses. That general philosophy is called empiricism. And that's what Petty is saying here. He says, I'm only going to appeal to visible foundations in nature, leaving those that depend upon the mutable mind, opinion, appetite, and passion of particular men to the consideration of others. He's not going to deal with any of those things. He's going to use number, weight, measure, arguments of sense, and he's going to base everything on visible foundations. Well, Petty wrote before Adam Smith, and Adam Smith rejected the mathematics, but he did not reject the empiricism. Adam Smith was an empiricist in economics. And after Smith, for the next 100 years until the late 19th century, positivism was the majority view. Smith's approach to economics was the one that Petty had rejected, intellectual arguments and the use of words. Both Smith and Petty relied on observation. And then again in the 20th century, positivism, the use of mathematics again, becomes the predominant method. And we call it econometrics or something of that sort. The most famous economists, and we mentioned many of them yesterday, differed on the subject matter of economics. They differed on what they were talking about. They differed on their method, the proper method to use. In the late 19th century, Jevons, William Stanley Jevons, that was the name that came up yesterday. Here's my pen. William Stanley Jevons picked up where Petty had left off in the 17th century, and he wrote that it is clear that economics, if it's to be a science at all, has to be a mathematical science. Has to be a mathematical science. And then notice what he says. I'm going to read a few sentences from Jevons because it's important to the idea of method. He says, in reality, there is no such thing as an exact science. Perhaps you've heard that phrase, exact science. Some sciences, he says, are inexact. Some sciences, we say, are exact. He says there's no such thing as an exact science, except in the comparative sense. Astronomy is more exact than other sciences because the position of a planet or a star admits of close measurement. Well, sometimes you hear the astronomers revise their measurements, and usually when they do, they're by astronomical magnitudes. No, we were off by 50%, or we're off by 25%, which when we're talking about distances in astronomy are, or can be, thousands of light years. In any case, he says, if we examine the methods of astronomy, we find that they're all approximate. See, this is something, again, that young students usually are not told. Every solution involves hypotheses which are not really true. This is Jevons writing about astronomy. And he's going to make the point even more so as it applies to economics. Every solution in astronomy involves hypotheses which are not really true. As, for instance, that the Earth is a smooth, homogeneous spheroid. Even the apparently simpler problems in statics or dynamics are only hypothetical approximations to the truth. You find this admitted, statements of this source, of this sort, admitted by scientists repeatedly through history. And yet many Christians persist in believing that science furnishes us with truth. Well, Jevons, as you recall, was one of the three economists, along with Valois and Menger, who came up with the idea of subjective value about 1870. Menger, who tended to be, or whose school tended to be more rationalist, remained an empiricist himself. His student, or one of his grand students, I guess you would call them, his student's student, Mises, was very much of a rationalist, and we'll get to rationalism in a moment after we've talked a little bit more about empiricism in economics. Menger, early in his career, said that in reality, a method common to all fields of empirical knowledge is sense observation and should properly be called the empirical method. And then he goes on to say, and this is a quote from Menger, the founder of the Austrian school. Menger goes on to say, the impartial observer can have no doubt about the reason our generation pays general an enthusiastic tribute to progress in the field of the natural sciences. While economic sciences, science receives little attention and its value is seriously questioned by the very men to whom it should provide a guide for practical action. The cause of such a remarkable indifference must not be sought elsewhere than in the present state of our science itself, in the sterility of all past endeavors to find its empirical foundations. Says the general public has a great respect, he's writing at the end of the 19th century, has a great respect for physical science, but has little respect for economic science. And he says, the difference is, we have yet to come up with a sound empirical method. The natural scientists, the physicists, and the biologists have. They've already come up with their method, and that's why the public respects them. Perhaps the most famous proponent of empirical economics, at least in the U.S., in the 20th century, is Milton Friedman. Let me put that name up. Milton Friedman at the Chicago, University of Chicago. He's now at Hoover, the Hoover Institution in California. He hasn't been in Chicago for 20 years, I guess. But that's where he did most of his most famous work. He published an essay in 1953 on economic method. And this is what he says that economists are supposed to do, or what he says about economics. He says, the task of economics is to make correct predictions. That's the task, to make correct predictions. That's why economists are always making predictions. Very few of them are ever correct. But that's the task, is to make correct predictions. He says, about the consequences of any change in circumstances. Well, if you think about it, that's what scientists do as well. In astronomy, going back to that subject again, they make correct predictions or try to make predictions about eclipses. You know, you can tell what day, what hour, maybe even what minute an eclipse will begin. This summer, the concern seems to be about collisions of asteroids or comets with the Earth, trying to predict those things. We had a scare just 2 months ago, I guess it was. Some scientist released the report that, I think it was in the year 2028, an asteroid would pass very close to the Earth and perhaps collide with the Earth. And as soon as his statement was released, some other scientists denied it. And the accounts that I've read of this is the second scientist said that he made his calculations in 15 minutes. And said that this asteroid would not even come close to the Earth, let alone possibly collide with it in the year 2028. Well, who knows what's going to happen in the year 2028. But both of them agree that the job, or one of the jobs of science in any case, is to make predictions. You try to make them as accurately as possible, but that's very difficult to do. Friedman goes on and he says, its performance, that is, the performance of economics, is to be judged by the precision, scope, and conformity with experience of the predictions it yields. That is, you judge economics if it gives you accurate predictions. You judge it to be correct. If those predictions are precise, if they conform to what actually happens. In short, he says, positive economics is an objective science in precisely the same way as any other physical science. I don't know why he thinks economics is a physical science, but this gets back to William Petty again. Petty is saying he's going to rest everything on visible foundations. He says it's an exact science, it's an objective science in precisely the same way that astronomy is, or physics. Then he says the ultimate goal of economics is the development of a theory or hypothesis that yields valid and meaningful predictions about phenomena not yet observed. As you take what you have observed and you draw inferences from those things, you draw conclusions about things you haven't observed yet. Because that's the ultimate goal of economics. It says, viewed as a body, continuing with Friedman, viewed as a body of hypotheses, theory is to be judged by its predictive power. Only factual evidence can show whether it is right or wrong. And then he qualifies that. He says, or better, tentatively accepted as valid or rejected. The only relevant test of the validity of a hypothesis is comparison of its predictions with experience. The hypothesis is rejected if its predictions are contradicted. It is accepted if its predictions are not contradicted. Great confidence is attached to it if it has survived many opportunities for contradiction. But then he writes, and this is Friedman again, factual evidence can never prove an hypothesis. Factual evidence can never prove an economic hypothesis or a scientific hypothesis. It can only fail to disprove it, which is what we generally mean when we say, somewhat inexactly, that the hypothesis has been confirmed by experience. And he puts the word confirmed in quotation marks. And when you do that, and you're not quoting anyone, it means you don't really mean what the word says. So it's really not confirmed, it's just that we failed to contradict it. But there, the important statement is, factual evidence can never, notice the word never, prove an hypothesis. Now where does this leave Friedman's economics? He's already said the task of economics is to make predictions. And you judge the economic theory on the basis of the accuracy of those predictions. But then he says, the facts can never prove the hypothesis. So you aren't left with very much. By his own account, he realizes the limitations of his method. But Friedman is not a Christian. Friedman is of Jewish extraction, but the last I knew did not make any profession of belief at all in as far as Judaism goes. But he realizes that economics cannot provide truth. Yet he persists in using the method. Now, one would think that people who persist in using the method and spend their entire lives knowing that the method is never going to yield truth, never is his word, you can never confirm an hypothesis. Knowing it's never going to confirm a hypothesis, one might think that perhaps somewhere in the back of their mind, they realize that the whole thing is a waste of time. But perhaps they don't. But Friedman here has dedicated 70 years to this method and to his development of economics. Another quote from Friedman, the validity of a hypothesis in this sense is not by itself a sufficient criterion for choosing among alternative hypotheses. Observe facts, and this is very important, Observed facts are necessarily finite in number, possible hypotheses infinite. If there is one hypothesis that is consistent with available evidence, there is always an infinite number that are. Now, this gets even worse. Looking at this from a logical point of view, this is even worse than what he said so far. He said the observed facts are necessarily finite. Facts are limited in number, but the possible hypotheses to explain the facts are infinite in number. He says if there's one hypothesis that is consistent with the available evidence, there's always an infinite number that are. So you see now that economics, empirical economics, is in the same boat, the same sinking boat, as empirical science, generally. If there are an infinite number of possible hypotheses to explain the facts, whatever the facts may be, then Milton Friedman's chance of choosing the correct hypotheses is zero. We can say not only are his hypotheses not confirmed, they're false. All of them. If you have an infinite number of possibilities and you choose one and you say, this is a law of economics, there's no possibility you choose the correct one. No possibility. Out of an infinite number. So all of his theories are false. We can go beyond saying they are not only not confirmed, they're all false. Well, if Friedman's correct here, the value of positive economics is zero, or empirical economics. All the laws of physics are false. All the laws of positive economics are false, or empirical economics are false as well. And the problem is a logical problem. The invalidity of induction. Now, that's another word I ought to put up here, induction. The logical invalidity of induction is the central fallacy that both the natural scientists and the economists are using. The better philosophers, such as David Hume or Karl Popper, realize that induction is a fallacy. Karl Popper wrote in the 20th century, I agree with David Hume's opinion that induction is invalid and is in no sense justified. Induction is invalid in every sense and therefore unjustifiable. What is induction? Induction, again, is the method of observation. You go out and you observe certain things, you observe certain facts, if you want to call them facts, and then you draw conclusions from them. That's the method of induction. And the philosophers like Hume and Popper admit that it's invalid. Another quote from Popper, the empirical basis of objective science has nothing absolute about it. Science does not rest upon solid bedrock. The bold structure of its theories rises, as it were, above a swamp. That's Karl Popper. Doesn't it sound a little bit like the comparison Christ made between building your house on the sand and building your house on a rock? And the foolish man builds his house on a rock. And here you have Karl Popper, not a Christian, an atheist, in fact, admitting that science does not rest upon solid bedrock. Its theories rise above a swamp. This is a quote from Karl Popper, the atheist philosopher of science. Now, again, we need to ask ourselves as Christians, why then are Christian apologists writing and speaking and publishing and defending the idea that science discovers truth? The scientists and the philosophers of science have already admitted that it doesn't. But apparently Christians don't read their books. And they're still operating on science as conceived in the 18th century or the 19th century. They ignore people like David Hume, who destroyed induction. Mises. Mises was not an empiricist. We'll get to him, as I said, in a moment when we talk about rationalism. But this is what he wrote. Mises was a brilliant economist. And he said, "The plight of empiricism consists precisely in its failure to explain satisfactorily how it is possible to observe from to infer from observed facts something concerning facts yet unobserved." So empiricism is a failure because induction is invalid. Let me give you a quote, and if you've heard me speak before on science, you probably have heard this quote, but it's from Bertrand Russell. Now, Bertrand Russell, again, was no Christian. In fact, he wrote a book. You can go down to Barnes & Noble and buy it, Why I Am Not a Christian. And Bertrand Russell was a mathematician, a logician in the 20th century, brilliant man. And I'll give you this quote from Russell on induction. And notice the peculiar way he expresses himself. He says, all inductive arguments, notice the all inductive arguments, in the last resort, reduce themselves to the following form. And then he gives this example about an inductive argument. If this is true, that is true. Okay? If I can make it applicable to the stock market, if the stock market crashed in 1987 only after it had declined gradually for 2 months, then it is true that in 1998 it's going to do the same thing after a decline of 2 months. He says, if this is true, that is true. Now, that is true, and in fact, that's what did happen in 1987. Therefore, this is true. Therefore, this is what's going to happen in 1998. And if you own stock, you better think of selling it when the bell rings tomorrow morning in New York. Russell says, the argument is fallacious. It's his word, formally fallacious. Then he gives this example. Suppose I were to say, if bread is a stone and stones are nourishing, why does he pick bread and stones? Well, he's read the Bible. If bread is a stone and stones are nourishing, then this bread will nourish me. Now this bread does nourish me, therefore it is a stone and stones are nourishing. He says, if I were to advance such an argument as this, I should certainly be thought foolish. Yet it would not be fundamentally different from the argument upon which all scientific laws are based. You get that statement? He said, if I were to advance an argument like this, people would think I'm foolish. He says, but this argument is not fundamentally different from the argument upon which all, and I underscore the all again, all scientific laws are based. Notice he uses the word foolish too. It's precisely what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, chapters 1, 2, and 3. The wisdom of this world is foolishness. God has made the wisdom of this world foolishness. And he includes among the wisdom of this world science, what we call science. Bertrand Russell, again, no axe to grind. He's not defending creation. He's not even defending theism. Certainly not defending the Bible. Thought Christ, if he existed, was an immoral man. Has no axe to grind in that sense. But he is candid enough to see the logic of the situation. And he admits, as Milton Friedman admitted, that the method produces no truth whatsoever. Absolutely not. No truth. Well, let me give you a few more quotes from Popper just to drive the point home. Popper writes, in science we do our best to find the truth, but we're conscious of the fact that we can never be sure we've got it. Notice the word never. We know that our scientific theories always remain hypotheses. Notice the always. In science there is no knowledge. Notice the no. No knowledge in the sense which Plato and Aristotle understood the word in the sense which implies finality. In science, we never, notice the never, have sufficient reason for the belief that we have attained the truth. Einstein declared that his theory was false. Perhaps many of you never heard that. Einstein declared his theory was false. He said it would be a better approximation to the truth than Newton's, but he gave reasons why he would not, even if all the predictions came out right, regard his theory as a true theory. See, it's the emphasis on prediction again. That's common in this view, this empirical view of science. And Einstein said, even if all the predictions made on the basis of my theories of relativity come out right, I will not regard my theory as true. Popper continues, our attempts to see and to find the truth are not final, but open to improvement. Our knowledge, our doctrine, is conjectural. Who can tell me what a conjecture is? What's a conjecture?
Guess.
A guess. Our knowledge, our doctrine, consists of guesses. And that's exactly what Popper says. In case you didn't get the Latin word conjecture, he says it consists of guesses, of hypotheses, rather than a final and certain truth. So you have a problem if you intend to do economics on the basis of empiricism. Friedman, perhaps, again, Friedman won the Nobel Prize in economics about 1976, I guess it was. Admitted, none of his economic theories was true. You judge them by their predictions, but then, even if the prediction is correct, you can't conclude the theory is true. Well, turning then from empiricism to rationalism, we'll begin that and get a few minutes into it. This is the second method in economics, as it's the second method in philosophy generally. The rationalist is completely different from the empiricist. And the best example of a rationalist in economic theory is Mises. His first name, let me give you his full name. Ludwig von Mises. He's an Austrian. Well, he wasn't the first. There was a French economist, Jean-Baptiste Say. I think I mentioned his name yesterday, who expressed a rationalist point of view in the 19th century, Jean-Baptiste Say. This is what he wrote. Jean-Baptiste is, of course, John the Baptist. People are too apt to suppose that absolute truth is confined to mathematics and to the results of careful observation and experiment in the physical sciences, imagining that the moral and political sciences contain no invariable facts of indisputable truth, and therefore cannot be considered as genuine sciences, but merely hypothetical systems. He's lamenting this fact. In the late 19th century, Menger began the new school of thought in Austria, and Mises developed it in a more consistent fashion than anyone else. Menger published a book in 1871 in which he discussed method in economic theory, and his book launched an intellectual war in Germany in the 1870s and 1880s. There was an intellectual battle going on. We talked today about cultural war in the U.S. Well, at the end of the 19th century in Germany, it was a philosophical war that was going on between the rationalists and various kinds of empiricists. This is what Menger wrote at this time. He says, the conflict about the nature of our science, its problems, and its limits, especially the effort to set new goals for research, did not originally develop from the interest of economists in theoretical investigations. It begins with the recognition, and notice how he says this, becoming more and more evident that the theory of economics as it left the hand of Adam Smith and his followers lacks any assured basis. Let me repeat that again. He says, this conflict over the proper method to use in economics begins with the recognition that the theory of economics as it left the hand of Adam Smith lacked any assured basis, that even its most elementary problems have found no solution, and that it is especially an insufficient basis for the practical sciences of national economy and thus also of practice in this field. That's the reason for the philosophical battles in Germany at the end of the 19th century. It lacks, he's writing in 1871, economics lacks any assured basis. Its most elementary problems have found no solution. After 100 years, this is right, he's writing 100 years after the Wealth of Nations. He also wrote, the progress of our science is hindered by the sway of erroneous methods. Then he rejects empiricism entirely. He started out as an empiricist, Menger did, but he rejects it entirely. He says, to want to test the pure theory of the economy by experience in its full reality is a process analogous to that of the mathematician who wants to correct the principles of geometry by measuring real objects. Who's taking geometry here? Okay. Let me ask you a point. Can you see a line? No. Somebody said the right answer. You cannot see a line. A geometrical line is invisible. Can you see a plane? No. A geometrical plane is invisible. So he's saying the absurdity of testing economic theory by checking it against the facts is like a mathematician trying to check the principles of geometry by going out and measuring boards and windows and whatever, real objects. The things that you use in geometry, the things that the teacher might put on the board, point or a line or a plane, are visible representations of those things that you cannot see. A point has no dimensions. Things with no dimensions are not visible. A line has one dimension, but this line here has at least two. Three, actually. You can't see a geometrical line. So he's saying it's absurd trying to check the facts or trying to check economic theory with the facts is like a mathematician trying to check geometry by getting out his ruler or his protractor or whatever and measuring real objects to see if triangles really do have 180 degrees. If geometry wasn't developed by someone going around with a protractor or whatever, measuring three-sided figures and concluding, yeah, they all have 180 degrees. That's not the way geometry begins. And he's making a very important point here. He says, the method of economics is similar to the method of geometry. That's what he's saying. He's taking a rationalist position. Economics doesn't depend on making observations. You start out with a few definitions, and you start out with a few assumptions, and then you begin to deduce a body of propositions, a body of doctrine that we call economics. Now, I'm going to cut it off there. I think we're out of time for questions as well, but if you'll hold your questions until we come back at 6 o'clock. I'll continue talking about rationalism before I get into the second and third hour subjects as well. We need to give rationalism more discussion than we have in just the past 10 minutes.